This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Friday, November 1st. Today, New York Times Justice Department correspondent Katie Benner will answer some of your listener questions about the impeachment process. We've been inviting you to call in 24/7 and leave a question on our voicemail, and we'll play a few of those today and hopefully clarify some things. Also, it's the day after the hyperpartisan Halloween vote for the public hearing rules. If you think things are already intense, we're about to enter the televised impeachment hearings era. We'll talk about that. And almost lost in the symbolic enormity of the rules vote yesterday was one of the most intriguing days yet of testimony from another top Trump official who was on the July 25th phone call. Europe and Russia advisor Tim Morrison, interestingly, gave some ammunition to both sides, and we'll talk about that. Our guide on the impeachment process trail today is Katie Benner, who covers the Justice Department for the New York Times. Hi, Katie. We appreciate this time. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with Tim Morrison, who has been the top Russia and Europe advisor on President Trump's National Security Council, another name that people never heard of until this week. But it's Tim Morrison, and his testimony was bad for Trump and good for Trump, from what I've been reading. And let's take the bad for Trump part first. According to the press accounts I've seen, Morris testified that he listened in on the July 25th phone call between President Trump and Ukraine's President Zelensky. And as a result of what he heard, he notified our ambassador to Ukraine, William Taylor, that the president was pushing to withhold security aid to Ukraine and a White House meeting for Zelensky until Ukraine announced investigations into the Bidens and a 2016 election conspiracy theory. In other words, the highest ranking official yet to say that, yes, it was a quid pro quo. What's the significance to you of Tim Morrison in particular stating that to the committees?
Well, I think that the most significant thing that we've seen is this slate of officials, including people as high ranking as Morrison, basically corroborating one another. Even though they seem to be in disagreement on the severity of these conversations, they all agree that they happened, and they all agree that the message was the same. We need Ukraine to do two things, or to at least discuss a couple of things that would be helpful to the president, helpful to his own personal campaign, before they get something that they want from us. So that idea at the heart of a quid pro quo, they are all verifying. Also, what's interesting is Morrison is another one of these figures who we've never heard of, but he has almost a Zelig-like presence in the other witness interviews. His name keeps coming up again and again. So it was really, really important that when he testified that the things that he said tracked with the people who'd come before him.
So that's the bad for Trump part. Maybe good for Trump is this. Reportedly, while Morrison is more confirmation of the quid pro quo nature of Trump's demands, Morrison didn't necessarily find them disturbing or illegal. How specifically do you know about what he said regarding that?
Well, you know, he said he didn't have any reason to believe that the Ukrainians themselves knew that U.S. aid was being withheld because Trump wanted certain things from them. So he sort of shades that a little bit. That's something that there's been reporting that the Ukrainians would have known, and there have been people who believe that the Ukrainians knew. And then also his testimony differs slightly from Bill Taylor, another longtime government servant. He differs slightly on the details of the arrangement. Morrison remembers Sondland saying that a senior Ukrainian official saying to this official that the U.S. would be satisfied if the prosecutor general of Ukraine publicly committed to conducting the investigations that Trump wanted, whereas Taylor said that it had to be the Ukrainian president. And while that is for some a distinction without a difference, you know, it does sort of take some of the heat off of the conversation itself that was listened to in July, this idea that the president himself had been putting the screws to the president of Ukraine in this ultra-aggressive way.
So based on the accounts of the witnesses this week and last, do you think we're headed toward these televised hearings with Ambassador Taylor finding it really disturbing, Colonel Vindman, who was on the call, finding it really disturbing, and Mr. Morrison, who was on the call, not so much, and okay, American people, now you decide?
Yeah, I mean, what will be interesting is, keep in mind, we don't actually know the full breadth of everything everybody has said in these closed-door hearings. We have a flavor of their conversations, but it will be, if the Democrats are skilled questioners, and this is an if, What they will do is they will narrowly tailor their questions to the witnesses that seem more blasé about the events as they unfolded, just to elicit the facts from them, and then use witnesses like Vindman to bring a more heightened emotional tone to the proceeding, and also to put into the context of what does this mean for America and what does this mean for patriotism. We also do know that for Trump, these hearings pose a big deal for him. Everything that's been happening behind closed doors, he's been able to bat away. He has said that they are totally a sham. But we all know that he responds very differently when he sees things on television. It's much more emotionally heightened for him, too. And then that creates its own wild card, because then who knows what he'll say and do.
And that actually brings us to our first listener question. Listen to this.
My name is Jenny Gelms, and I'm calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And my question is, given that refusal to participate in a congressional investigation, refusal to answer the committee subpoenas, is in and of itself a separate impeachable offense, what strategy the administration or the president's legal team is hoping to press by engaging in an arguable impeachable offense during the course of this impeachment investigation? What does the administration hope to gain from openly participating in a separate impeachable offense?
Katie, is there an objective answer to Jenny's question, or is it all a matter of politics?
You know, I think if you take a step back, if the White House strategy so far has been to say this entire process is illegitimate, full stop, participating in another offense that could be impeachable is probably not going to be a top-of-mind worry, because what they want to do is they want to undermine the validity of the entire impeachment process. It's a very similar strategy that they employed when Bob Mueller was investigating the Russian election interference. The difference here is that the Mueller investigation was completely private. We didn't know what was going on. We had no visibility, and the Mueller team itself could never respond to the president. So they had 2 years of runway to undermine the validity of the entire investigation in the minds of their constituents. That's not the case here. So, you know, it's harder to make that argument, yet it's the argument they're making. So pile on the impeachable offenses. It almost is immaterial if you're working from a standpoint of none of this matters. It is all just wrong, full stop.
The next listener question is a follow-up on our interview this week with Intelligence Committee member Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney.
Hi, this is Carol from Wilton, Connecticut. This is a follow-up on your interview with Representative Maloney. It's a question that you asked, Brian, but it didn't get answered. That it relates to National Security Council's Chief Counsel Eisenberg. You asked the congressman, what did Colonel Vindman and his superior, Fiona Hill, expect to happen when they went to Eisenberg with their concerns about the phone call between the president and the Ukrainian president? It looks like Eisenberg's name keeps coming up as perhaps someone who helped to shelve into deep classification the transcript of the phone call, and who also intercepted the whistleblower's report on the phone call. So it's a question of what was Eisenberg's role when he received these concerns from members of the National Security Council?
Thanks, Carol. So, Katie, the Trump appointees, alarmed by what they were hearing, reported it to the National Security Council lawyer, and the question is out there, as Carol in Connecticut is asking, did that lawyer then represent those concerns by National Security staff, or did he turn around and help the president hide the evidence?
So I think that Eisenberg is one of the many figures in this, I don't even know what word to use, depending on your point of view. It's a complete fiasco. It's certainly something that has been troubling to many. He is an interesting figure in that he shows how difficult it is for the executive branch to police itself and to have actually any real oversight over the president. So people were bringing him complaints because as the lawyer for the National Security Council, they were hopeful that he would take this information, he would take their concerns, and then find some way to elevate it so there could be some sort of conversation, discussion, action plan, who knows, that would address behavior that multiple people felt undermined American national security in order to advance a personal agenda of the president. So the hope was that he could do something, essentially. Maybe there could be some sort of plan. Maybe there could be a new protocol. Maybe there could be a way to talk about what had happened, full stop, without any end goal. You know, I don't think people were coming to him because they felt, okay, if I come to him, then A, B, and C will happen. I don't think people knew it would happen after. They just wanted it to be known that they didn't think that the events had been correct or correctly handled. But what's so interesting is that whether it's Eisenberg or whether it's other national security professionals who are aware of this, what are their options? You know, we saw this very early on when the director of DNI and the IC inspector general, they said, we need legal advice, but who can we go to for legal advice? Well, we have to go to the Justice Department, where a political appointee who serves at the pleasure of the president will give us legal advice. You have people going to Eisenberg saying, okay, well, where else do we have to turn? We have to go to this attorney at the National Security Council. But then he also is a part of the White House. And so he has a duty to also, you know, be a part of the White House. None of these positions are designed to actually have oversight over the president himself. And that is one of the key lessons that we've learned in seeing how all these officials scramble to try to figure out how to deal with a situation that they felt was unorthodox or even irresponsible or dangerous with very few tools. It is, again, another reason why the Constitution has set up an impeachment process, an impeachment hearing process, because the only person who can conduct oversight over the president truly is Congress.
Fascinating. And so maybe we'll find out in the televised hearings what Eisenberg actually did with this information, but you're describing how structurally he's conflicted and constrained. Here's another question. We actually had two callers asking similar questions along the same lines, and we will play both. Here's one.
Hi, my name is Klein Bentley from Portland, Oregon. My question is, once the impeachment process reaches the Senate, are there rules of evidence? And if not, if it is a purely political process, then what is the purpose of the Chief Justice presiding over the proceeding? Thanks. Bye.
So there's that, and here's another version.
I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina, and I have a question about the Senate trial and what that might look like. The Constitution doesn't really give a whole lot of guidance about that, and with Chief Justice Roberts overseeing it, and Mitch McConnell being involved, is there any concern that it could turn into a megaphone for the GOP to denigrate what has occurred so far with what the House is doing?
Thank you for your call. So can you explain, number one, are there rules of evidence for a Senate impeachment trial?
Yes, so the Senate impeachment trial actually looks a lot like a courtroom trial. It's not so different. And it is basically to hear the evidence that the House has gathered and decide whether or not to remove the president, right? And you have a few important differences. You have an unusually large jury. It's 100 senators instead of 12 peers, and the amount of votes that it takes. But at the end of the day, there's almost a foregone conclusion of how the Senate's going to vote. Republicans control the Senate. They're not going to get the two-thirds people needed, the Democrats will not get the two-thirds number of votes necessary in order to remove President Trump. So there is a way in which, while we are going through this entire proceeding, we already in some ways feel like we know the outcome, which is that President Trump will remain president no matter what because of the Senate vote. Now, that said, there's still two important reasons to do this process. One is what I had referred to before in the last question, that there's only one way to have oversight over the president, and that is through something like Congress stepping in and doing something, right? Congress is the oversight mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you are a Democrat or you're a Republican and you truly believe that the president has done something wrong and you abdicate that oversight responsibility altogether just because you don't think you're going to win, that historically, for democracy, for the Constitution, and for history, that's bad. This is just not what you want. And then two, the timing on this is very, very interesting. The trial is happening in the months before a general election. Now, there are opponents of the president who for a long time have said that his behavior is bad for national security. We're going to get an incredibly complete account of facts that support that idea just before an election. So, you know, we had that with the Mueller report, but instead of live testimony and a hearing, something that people are really used to seeing, we had a 400-plus page legalese-filled report that nobody read, this is going to be very, very different. And so in some ways, it creates more peril for the president than not having an impeachment hearing would, of course, and then also not having a forum in which to air a lot of evidence that could be very damning to him just before voters go to the polls.
And the role of Chief Justice Roberts?
So the role of Chief Justice Roberts, I am not going to be able to get into as much as some other guests might. So I'm going to punt on that question for now.
Okay. So we will promise our callers from Portland and from North Carolina that we will follow up on that in future episodes. Before you go, a couple of quick things. You wrote an article about Attorney General Barr trying to dig himself out of the perception that he's acting as Trump's personal lawyer rather than Attorney General for the people of the United States. But your Times colleague, Emily Bazelon, also just wrote an article about Barr being a pro-Trumper because Barr is mostly a religious right activist and Trump is backing up that agenda, kind of like with Mike Pence. And your Times colleague, Gail Collins, just did a reader poll and her readers rank Barr as the worst Trump appointee of the whole 3 years. Unscientific, somewhat tongue-in-cheek poll, but he's a hot button to be sure. My question for you is Barr now irrelevant to the impeachment inquiry because it's in the hands of Congress, or can he help the president like he did with the Mueller report if he wants to?
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to make a very important distinction that while Emily and Gail are extremely esteemed colleagues and both very wonderful people, they write for the op-ed section of the New York Times. I am a reporter, so I'm probably never going to write a story that says that Bill Barr is the worst person in the world.
Got it.
Because they are op-ed columnists. This is a very, very important distinction that people always forget. So moving on from that, yes, there is a sense that Bill Barr, though, is, I'll say this about him. He is one of the most skilled operators in this cabinet. This is his second stint as Attorney General. He understands the inner workings of the executive branch extremely well. He is not a rookie by any means, and he is extremely intelligent. So if he wants to pull the levers of government, he can, and he can find ways to do it within the letter of the law. He's a very keen legal mind, of course, because he's the Attorney General, but he's also a really great political operator. So on something like this, right now it seems like the entire impeachment inquiry is very much focused on the Defense Department, and especially the State Department, of course, all of the diplomats, the funding, and then OMB, the Office of Management Budget, like what's going on with this money? What was the president doing in his exchanges with Ukraine? It doesn't really seem to impact the Justice Department. Now, keep in mind, of course, Bill Barr has really tight relationships with lots of people on the Hill and lots of Republicans. He's still a very influential voice. He is somebody who can make the sorts of legal arguments that so far the White House, I don't think, has really been able to make around why Trump did was not wrong. And should he choose to do that, he would probably be very good at it and possibly better at it than anybody else in the administration. Keep in mind, so far, we haven't really seen a lot of great arguments saying that the president did nothing wrong. All the arguments have been, this process is not right, this process is a sham. And even those arguments are weak because, as people have mentioned, in the Constitution, the process is not very explicitly laid out. And so it's really up to Congress to decide on its own process. So, you know, can Barr have influence and impact? Certainly he can. Will he? I think that's to be seen. But certainly as the hearing heats up, when it goes to the Senate and there really is a vote, he is one of the people who behind the scenes has a lot of influence, a lot of clout, and would be a great argument person to argue in the corner of the president.
Katie Benner, New York Times Justice Department correspondent, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And last thing on the impeachment news for today, just for some comic relief, folks, no matter what your politics or what you think about impeachment, this moment has to be at least a little bit rich. Donald Trump Jr. on Sean Hannity.
I wish my name was Hunter Biden. I could go abroad, make millions off of my father's presidency. I'd be a really rich guy.
If he doesn't realize what he just did there, then irony really is dead. Again, listeners, you can call and ask an impeachment news question. Just leave a voicemail anytime, including your name and where you're calling from, and some of you will hear your questions on the show. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-TALK or 844-745-8255. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org. Have a great weekend. Talk to you Monday.